Boat Trader, America's largest boating marketplace, offering easy financing and over 100,000 boat listings to choose from. Sell, find, and finance new or used boats on America's largest boating marketplace. Visit BoatTrader.com to get started.
Knives, machetes, saws, and shears. Multi-tools, shovels, swords, axes, spears, hatchets, and tomahawks. If it cuts, snips, slices, or chops, Midway USA has it. Find great gift ideas in our huge selection of pocket knives and other everyday carry folding knives. Make a statement or create a family legacy with one of our top-of-the-line hunting knives. We've got a great selection of manual and electric sharpeners, too. For just about everything for the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
When we look at greatness, right, people who are great, people who have done great things, we tend to want to summarize them as someone who is from another planet, someone who's cut from a different cloth, someone who has been genetically gifted, and that they are predisposed, preconditioned for greatness. And that is not the case whatsoever, right? I was in that same boat. I'm still in that same boat. What I've come to realize is that greatness exists within every single one of us, right? Every single one of us, human flesh, blood and tissue. And it's just a matter of getting your mind wrapped around who you want to become and then putting in that work to get it done. And that's it.
I'm Nick Lavery, and this is the Tom Rowland Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast today. We have a spectacular show for you today. I just finished this show, and I'm very, very excited about it. I was put in touch with this individual by my friend Scott Brown, and this particular individual, I'm going to read his resume because I know that he will not talk about it himself, but Nick Lavery. Nick Lavery is a Green Beret warrant officer. He has three Purple Hearts, a Silver Star, a Bronze Star, a Bronze Star with Valor for heroism in combat. He is really an exceptional person. He is the first above the knee amputee to go back to active duty as a Green Beret. He had been injured three different times in combat. One was pretty serious where it, they were all pretty serious, but the one resulted in him having his leg amputated. And he determined that he was going to go back to his team. He was going to go back to the people that that needed him. And that's exactly what he did after a full year of recovery in Walter Reed. So that experience obviously taught him some lessons. It obviously, he had to rely on his training that he had before. And it all goes back to mindset, really, with Nick. We talk about mindset a tremendous amount in this podcast and how he was able to use a positive mindset, a certain mindset to recover, get back to his teams, and go on to have a really long military career that's lasting even to today. He's about to be deployed again. So Nick Lavery is our guest today. He is really something. So stay tuned, take notes, get ready for this awesome conversation with Green Beret Warrant Officer Nick Lavery. Nick, how you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Man, I'm doing great. I've had a great morning. Already got my workout in. Everything's going great.
Yep.
Great way to start the day.
Yeah, man. Likewise. The only way to start the day.
Are you a morning? Probably in your profession, you're always a morning person, but would you consider yourself a morning person? Do you like to get the day started real early?
I do get the day started early. I don't always like it though. You know, some days I spring up out of bed at 4 a.m. without the alarm clock going off and I'm fired up. Most days I have to drag myself up, but I do get going early in the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good deal. Well, to bring the listeners up to speed, I have dug into your story quite a bit. We have a mutual friend in Scott Brown that introduced us, and I've talked to him considerably about you. But I would love to bring the listeners up to speed on who you are and what your story is.
Yeah, man. I guess who I am first and foremost is I'm a family man. That's what I identify with more than anything else, by far. So I'm a husband. I'm a father of 1 3-year-old boy. However, we have a second boy that is on the way.
Oh, nice.
ETA sometime mid-March.
Right on.
So we're excited about that. Yeah, yeah. So I honestly, man, I could stop describing myself right there and be totally content with that.
Yeah.
A little bit beyond that, I'm from Boston. If really? You haven't already figured that out yet.
I thought you were from South Alabama.
Yeah, spoiler alert. Boston, Mass, born and raised. Went to college up there. Went to University of Massachusetts at Lowell, played football, got my bachelor's degree in criminology, and then looked at options to enlist. Came into the Army in 2007 as a Special Forces recruit, which is known as the 18X-ray program. Did that, went over to 3rd Group out of Fort Bragg as an 18 Bravo, which are the weapons sergeants. Did that for a while, deployed a bunch of times, eventually transferred to 5th Group, which is where I'm at now, out of Fort Campbell. Made that move because my wife is also active duty Army. She came down on orders here for Fort Campbell. So transferred groups, been here now almost 4 years, something like that. And last year I transitioned to become a warrant officer, which is still a transition I'm trying to figure out. You know, by the time I figure it out, it'll probably be time for me to move on to the next job. That's kind of how the Army works. And yeah, man, my team and I, we're in the final preparation phase for this next deployment that's coming up here real quick. And yeah, man, that's the wave top introduction right there, brother.
Okay. And somewhere along the line, there was a pretty significant part of the story that you didn't cover, and that is that you were pretty severely injured in combat and had an amputation above the knee.
Yeah, that's correct. And what's funny about that, man, and whether I'm in an interview or doing a podcast or something, and it's not intentional, but when I describe my background and who I am, I tend to just not mention that. You know, I kind of just like blast over it, and everyone's like, wait, hold on a second. Like, you're an amputee, you're missing your leg, you're doing stuff. Like, that's kind of a big part of your life, and you didn't even mention it. Which I understand, it's ironic because I don't really identify super close as an amputee or as a wounded warrior. I'm obviously not ignorant to the fact that it's part of my reality. But I make that mistake, I guess if you could call it, pretty consistently. But yeah, man, on my second deployment to Afghanistan, my second combat trip to Afghanistan anyway, in 2012, going into 2013, I was injured 3 times over there on 3 separate occasions. And the last one, which was just about a week before, well, maybe a week or two ish before we were set to leave. My team and I fell victim to an insider attack, sometimes referred to as a green on blue incident. And, I took a bunch of rounds to both of my legs. Most of the damage was to my right leg. Shattered my femur. Severed my femoral artery, really had almost no business surviving that incident, but I did. You know, spent a year at Walter Reed, going through rehab and learning how to live life as a one-legged dude before returning back to Fort Bragg, got back to my unit, was assigned a job as an instructor, which was awesome, something I requested. And from that point, I began working the process to get back to operational status, which is something I'm proud to say I was successful at doing.
That's that had to be, and looking into your story, there were all kinds of assessments that you were going to have to go through once that you started to get to the point to where you were getting healthy, you were realizing, okay, I'm getting there, I'm going to do this. And then there's a tremendous amount of assessments that you have to pass, not only for the Army, but for your team as well, and for your own kind of realization that you are an asset.
Yeah. So what was interesting about it, man, is I had been working as an instructor. So I was on the SOCP committee, which stands for Special Operations Combatives Program. And we are charged with teaching hand-to-hand combat and close quarters battle to the members of the SF unit that we belong to. I had been doing that for about 8 months once I got back to the unit. And I, at that time, I was training pretty much out of my mind. You know, the goal from the very beginning was to get back to the team. And after about that 8 month stretch of just about nothing but work, train, eat, sleep, that's really all I did. I voiced to my command that I felt like I was ready to give it a shot. And they knew immediately once I got back there, even prior to me getting back there, what my intentions were. But there really wasn't a laid out pipeline, right? Like this nice clean pipeline, like the Q course or any other of these programs where it's just, okay, A, then B, then C. It really wasn't like that. They just decided to begin throwing these assessments at me. So I started off with just your basic physical fitness test, and then another Army for record physical fitness test. And then it just kind of kept going. You know, I was doing one assessment usually every week or two. And that was about a 3 month process. And I got put through the ringer, and, you know, rightfully so. I would have expected nothing less. You know, physical was obviously a big part of it. I also was given a kind of a proficiency reevaluation as an 18 Bravo. I was put through another psych screen because, again, I was borderline out of my mind. And I think people around me kind of picked up on that. Like, they want to make sure this guy's not genuinely crazy for what he's trying to do here. So that process took just about 3 months, and it was brutal. And, you know, upon the conclusion of my last physical assessment, which was actually created by Third Group at the time, specifically to replicate the activities of combat. They have since turned that into an assessment that they use across the regiment, which is pretty cool. Finished that. And I had kind of earned the confidence and the trust of not only my teammates, but the command. And they gave me the approval to go back to the team.
So you're like a pretty physically, you're a physical standout. 6'6", is that right? Big dude. 6'6".
Yeah, 6'5", 6'6", somewhere in there.
6'5", 6'6". You've been a physical standout your entire life. I would imagine that the first time that you go through selection, the first time that you're going through the initial assessments, you're doing really well in the physical, right?
Yeah. Grew up playing sports, grew up doing combat sports, played football at college. I would say I was about 70% brawn, 30% brain. And my physical traits and my aggressiveness is what I brought to the table. It was what I enjoyed. It was what I was good at, and it was what my team wanted from me. So it was a win-win across the board.
Yeah. And so when you are coming back from this injury and the amputation, and you're going through these assessments, did you come upon any realizations that while you were passing the assessments, you were doing things, you were having to learn how to do things differently, or anything? Was that difficult at all?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And actually, man, it started long before I began this assessment process. It actually started back when I was in the hospital, and General Cleveland, who at the time was the USASOC commander, came and visited me while I was still in inpatient status at Walter Reed. So I'm still going through surgeries 2 or 3 times a week. I'm still in real rough shape. He came to visit me, and long story short, he kind of laid out his design for his vision for SF or for Army Special Operations moving forward, a document referred to as ARSOF 2022, which at the time of this visit by him was not made public. It was just about to be released. And it just talked about
the future of SOF and how we can make an impact. And there was an enormous emphasis on the need to pay attention to the human dynamic in the operating environment that we live within. And immediately following that visit, I began wrapping my mind around ways that I could increase my value aside from my physical characteristics. And in SF specifically, in the Army Special Forces, there are a lot of options for us to expand our potential and our value because we have such a broad mission set, right? We do the direct action, cool guy stuff, the kick and indoors thing that we all love to do, but there's also an entire plethora of other activities and things that we are expected to be proficient at and then get tasked to go do. So I began exploring those options, different schools, both military and on the civilian side, ways that I could increase my cerebral capacity to increase my mind to equal as much of a weapon as I felt my body was. Because I knew I was realistic. I knew that there's no way I was going to be as physically dominant as I was as a one-legged guy. You know, it's not something that's easy to digest, but you have to be pragmatic about where you're at. And I could train all day, every day, which I do. It's just I'm not gonna be as I was. So how can I raise that stock and raise that value? And it was through these other arenas that I began to explore options. And I didn't like any of it. It was painful, but I felt it was necessary to be that asset that I wanted to continue to be. Going through the assessments specifically. I mean, at this point, I was still maybe just 18 months or so out from having lost a leg, which is still really early on in the process of being an amputee. I have these events and I knew what the events were. I knew the kinds of things that would be asked of me. And I would just start, you know, playing around with different techniques. How does this work? How does that work? It's a lot like drilling in jiu-jitsu is kind of the analogy I use. You know, you just have to drill it over and over and over and over again. Trial and error, make small adjustments, trial and error, until you find a system or method that looks like it's going to be the most promising, and then just gradually build up strength and endurance. So that was the process. Is I was training for general strength, general endurance, my jiu-jitsu game, and then I was also doing specific training for these events that I knew were coming down the pipe at some point. So it was just a nonstop back and forth, very meticulous, very methodical process to learn how I can do certain movements as a guy with just one leg.
Right. One of the things that at that part of your story that I thought was pretty interesting is it's obvious that you started to look towards the things that you can do rather than focusing on the things that you can't do. And that's where a lot of people have a real problem, is that, you know, you get injured, you're an athlete, you get injured. Oh, I can't run anymore. I can't run, you know, for the next 5 months. I tore my calf muscle, or I did something. And they start focusing on all of the things that they can't do rather than focusing on, look at all these other things that I can do. This is a great opportunity to get really strong at pull-ups, or this is a great opportunity to enhance my training in another way. Or, you know, it could be somebody that lost their job, or somebody that had some sort of a disappointment in their life, and they're thinking about all of the things that they can't do and focusing on those things, which is paralyzing them, right? So were you conscious of that? Like, I have to think about the things that I can do, focus on those things, get better at those things. Or was there a conscious decision to do that, or did that fall back on a lot of the training that you had already had?
Yeah, I mean, that was very specific and deliberate. And it began in my hospital bed, right? I mean, as I'm going through surgeries, I've got an external fixator that's holding my leg together, this giant metal apparatus that's sticking out of my body. I mean, I'm in real rough shape. Obviously, I'm not doing the types of physical training that I would normally be doing. But what can I do from this hospital bed right now? Bring in some bands, bring in some 2-pound dumbbells. I mean, literally, right? Here goes from a guy who at the time of my injury was about 280 pounds, right? Of mostly muscle. It one of my peak I've been in my life, to instantaneously be in a hospital bed. You know, I lost 60, 70 pounds. I'm obviously a mess. And I'm lifting a 2-pound dumbbell in a hospital bed, right? That's one, extremely humbling. But I thought it was super important because it allowed me to focus my energy on what I was able to do at that moment, which wasn't much, but I was able to get in there and get some work done. And as long as I was working, my mind and my body were making progress. It was very slow and steady, but I was still making progress. And that really didn't end. You know, it still doesn't end today, right? I mean, I was told back then that running for me would be completely out of the question, right? I'm too tall. My stump, which apparently is a derogatory term. So my residual limb, if you will, is too short. I don't have any muscle in my leg at all. Running is out, right? Well, I still run. You know, I run now, but it's very taxing on me. Where normally in the Army, running kind of goes hand in hand with physical fitness. I do it, but I don't do it as much. I find other ways to get in my cardio, to get in my endurance training. There are other ways that I can still meet the intent, which is to be physically fit and have the endurance, the cardiovascular capacity that I need to do my job. So I just think it all starts in the mind. And, you know, we'll probably circle back to mindset and mentality a lot here because it's just so interwoven in what we are able to do in three-dimensional time and space. It all begins in your mind, man. And I just think, generally speaking, we need to be rigid on the goal, but we need to remain flexible on the approach. And we tend to be comfortable doing the things that we have done and we like to do and we're good at. But sometimes that may not be an option at that moment. So you need to flex and find what you can do. And you may not enjoy it, but you're going to get the results that you're looking for at the end of the day. And that's really what it's about. Finding a way to continue to work at what you are able to do. Double and triple down on what you can do, while also not completely neglecting the things that you want or need to get better at.
Man, that's good advice. And it can be applied to so many different areas of anyone's life. In your case, it's been tested at the, you know, basically the extreme end. So that advice is sound for sure. Let's talk about discipline for a little bit. What does discipline mean to you? Because it obviously seems like you had to be incredibly disciplined to first of all, to become a Green Beret. You have to have a tremendous amount of discipline. You have to then rely on that discipline as you're doing this whole healing process and getting back to the teams. But in your, how do you describe discipline?
I would describe discipline as a combination of sacrifice and time prioritization. Sacrifice being basically giving up the things that you are fortunate to have, right? I am fortunate to have a warm bed to sleep in and I want to stay in it. I'm fortunate to have a pizza in front of me because I can afford it, or I have a spouse that brought one home. I'm fortunate to have this delicious, tasty treat in front of me right now. Giving up those things, right? That is sacrifice. And oftentimes, to tie that into discipline, it's then in conjunction with doing something other than that that is more beneficial to you in the long run, right? So giving up immediate satisfaction for enduring self-respect. Sacrificing what I want for what I need. And I don't think it needs to be exclusive. I don't think that we are only to do the things we need to do always, right? There should be some kind of a balance that exists that will constantly teeter back and forth. Perfect balance, in my opinion, does not exist at all. But if you're only doing the things you have to do always, then life is going to be a chore and you're likely going to be miserable. And that's no way to go through life, right? We need to enjoy the process just as much as the prize. We need to enjoy the journey as much as getting to the actual top of the mountain, because this isn't a dress rehearsal, right? We have one shot at this thing. So we want to be happy and enjoy it and enjoy what we're doing. That just doesn't mean we get to do whatever we want all the time. So it's a give and take. And then time prioritization is just, you know, time is our most valuable resource. It's our most limited resource. Everyone has a problem with time. And it starts, I think, with just your vernacular. You know, I didn't have time. I ran out of time. I don't have time. It's like, no, you have the time. The time is given to all of us. We all have the same 24 hours in every day. We just simply choose how we use it. And oftentimes we have to do things that we may not want to do again, like go to work and eat food and shower, right? Like the things we need to do to just survive. Everything else, we just have to rack and stack those according to the priorities of those activities within that time. I think when you combine those two things together, you get discipline, which is another kind of enormous topic that's tied into a lot of this stuff and just in general success as it is overcoming adversity. Discipline is critical. I just think it all begins in your mind. Unfortunately, it can't stop there. That then has to transcend into physical action to create change within the actual world.
One of the things that I just picked up on there, that I've picked up on from other individuals like yourself, is that you mentioned the vernacular. You mentioned the words that you choose to use. How conscious are you of the words that you choose to use and how that affects your discipline, your habits, your attitude?
I pay attention to it, and I certainly make mistakes with my language use daily, for sure. But I hone in on it to the point where, I'll drive people around me crazy. You know, people don't speak in literal terms all the time, right? We as a human species, we've got expressions that we use that are not intended to be taken literally all the time. But I do think that there is an impactful connection between the words you use, whether they're internal or outwardly spoken, and what that does to your psyche, right? To actually have your mind and speak yourself forward, and getting rid of inaccurate, excuse-ridden type phrases and language, right? It is what it is. It's an expression that drives me batshit crazy, and it's used constantly. And I got it. It's just kind of an easy filler that people will throw out there. And what you're really saying is, I am a product of this and there's nothing I can do about it. Well, you can always do something about it. It is what you make it. It is not what it is. It is what you decide it is. It is what you decide to work in towards to create. And that's just one example. So I do pay attention to it, what I'm speaking within myself and then what I project. Because I think it's important. I think you need to train your mind to be able to get your body to move at a higher level. And a really easy way to begin that process is just paying attention to the words that are within your vocabulary.
Yeah. It's interesting that you said that it drives people around you crazy, because it certainly drives my wife crazy. I try to stay away from negative words. I try not to use them myself, like things like hate or, oh, this is going to be terrible, or the traffic was horrible, or any of those kind of things. And I'm like, that's a negative word. I try not to say it. So it drives my wife crazy. It really does. And that's a tricky thing too, because you're trying to navigate this thing in your own. You figured out that words are important. The way that you use words are important, but how do you, how you deal with the people that are around you and not drive them crazy, but stay on track is tricky. It really is. Yep. It's real tricky. I don't know if you got any insight on that, because it sounds like you have a little bit of the same experience that I do with that.
Yeah, no, I do, man. Especially when it comes to your spouse, you know, you really want to pick and choose those battles. I'm fortunate to be blessed to a high charging, savage such as my wife. So even when I maybe recommend an adjustment in language, she may tell me to get out of here with that kind of stuff right now. But she's also mature enough, and she's been through a lot to know that, yeah, okay, he's right. I just may not want to admit that right now, which is right. Just kind of standard husband and wife stuff. I think we need to be careful just in general, right? Whether we're talking about language or talking just about the people around us and how what we're doing or saying is impacting them. people decide to grow or decide to make a change on their own terms, right? And on their own timeline. And ideally, our productivity and our dedication and our discipline and our work ethic will have a positive impact on those around me. And oftentimes that does happen. That's the ultimate goal. There are times, however, where that can go the other direction. That can actually create a little bit of friction points with them, because they're seeing what you're doing and they're not in that place, right? They love you, they care about you, they're your teammate, your friend, your coach, whatever it is, but they're not there yet. And because of that, it can lead to some resentment going towards us, right? If we're the ones that are grinding and making changes and sacrifices and they're not there, it makes them feel lazy, right? It makes them feel inferior, and they take that out on us, right? I don't want to say they become haters, but they're just, it makes them feel bad about who they are, and that's projected towards us. And then it can also work the other way around, where we're grinding and we're getting after it, and those around us are not, because they're not there yet. And we can resent that. Hey, man, I'm working my ass off over here, and you're not doing shit. Like, what's the problem, right? So we resent them. I just think we need to be real cautious about that, particularly with those relationships that we need to preserve or really, really want to preserve, such as a spouse, a child, a mother, a father. Right. Friends, you know, that's where it gets a little interesting, man. That's where you really need to take a close look at your community and who you are surrounding yourselves with. And do they really need to be there? Tough call to make. But that community piece, I think, is a huge part of how we're able to progress towards what we're trying to do. You know, you hang around with losers, you're going to become a loser, right? Birds of a feather flock together. A lot of expressions out there. But I think that one of the fundamental keys to success is surrounding yourself with people who are like-minded, people who are driven, not necessarily towards the same exact goal, but people who have that ambition. And people who are better than us, people who push us to improve and get better, to try to compete with them.
Yeah, that has been one of the most challenging things for me. Those people seem to kind of shift in and out too. Like, you may have let's just say you start running and you want to do a marathon. Well, all of a sudden, you don't have to drop all your friends that don't care anything about running, but it is interesting to find another group of people that are interested in running, that have run many marathons, that know lots more than you do, and surround yourself with them for your training sessions, or surround yourself with them at a certain time. It doesn't mean you have to just ditch all your other friends because they don't like to run, but in some cases you might have that person that's super negative about it. That's like, why are you doing this, man? That's so stupid. Why are you trying to do that? I don't, maybe that's somebody that you have to cut out of your life, or at least for a time while you focus on this particular goal. But that is a really tricky one. And it becomes even more tricky when those people are real close loved ones that mean well. They really don't want to see you fail, or they really think that maybe this might not be the right road. And it's like, man, that one, when it's your parents, or it's your wife, or it's somebody that you really care about what they think, and they're, you know, they just don't want to see you get hurt. They just don't want to see you kind of extend yourself in a place where they don't know that you're going to be able to make it. That one's tricky.
Yeah, that is, man. And you hit the nail on the head, and it really resonates with me on a personal level. Because when I was in the hospital, my family and friends, they had a front row seat to my recovery, right? And I was as helpless as it gets, you know, for a while. I couldn't do anything for myself, eat, clean myself, nothing. I relied on my family, friends, and obviously the medical staff to do all those things for me. As I began to make my intentions clear to the people around me, I'm going back to the team, this is what I'm doing, period. A lot of people around me, right? Some of my closest family and friends on the exterior were like, yeah, man, you got this. Deep down inside, which has come out in conversations since, many of which I picked up in real time, was out of fear, right? They they didn't want to see me strive towards something that is unlikely to happen and be destroyed because of that. Right now, there's also the side of the house where they genuinely fear for me going back to combat. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about my pursuit of a goal that is statistically unlikely to happen. Right. Big goal. Right. Unprecedented. Right. No one in my family has ever done this before. I'm not talking to me specifically, generally. Right. You know, those of us in our family, we don't go to college. We don't start our own businesses. We don't do X. We don't climb Mount Kilimanjaro. Whatever it is, right? You are trying to do something that no one around you has done before and no one around you has even considered to do before. And out of fear of us failing or being defeated is the better term, they don't want us to do it, right? They're hesitant. They're not supportive.
And
they mean well.
They're trying.
It's out of love.
Yeah.
Right? It's out of love. And I went through that dynamic early on, and I threw that kind of 2-year process to get back to the team. And it's a tough road to navigate. You know, it's a tough road to navigate. I understood where they were coming from. My mother being a prime example. I knew that she wants nothing but the best of me in life. Right? My mother is the most loving human being on the planet. At the same time, her understanding of what Green Berets do was substantial, right? And she's like, there's no way that a one-legged guy, even if it's my son, is going to be able to do this. And at some point, he's going to get knocked off this track, and I'm concerned about what that's going to do to him and his well-being, right? It's out of love. So I just think we need to recognize it for what it is, not take that criticism or lack of support too harshly, and then surround ourselves again with those that are on the same team at that moment. It may just be temporary. In that moment, on our team, ready to go, and we maintain those other relationships as necessary to keep the ball moving forward.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. When we're talking about that, it's like nobody wants to see you fail. The people around you that really care about you, like in that situation, ultimately they don't want to see you fail because that could be very damaging, and they mean well. But when I think of failure, and when I looked into your story, you've got a interesting relationship with failure. How does failure work into your life?
Failure is something that I strive for daily, and I'm successful. And you know, it's pretty easy to be successful at reaching failure when you spend a lot of time doing physical training, because you can always push yourself and pick up more weight or try to run at a faster time and not be successful. And in my definition, that's failure. Right now, that's a small failure. Right, it's not the end of the world by any stretch, but we want to live at the edge of our capability. And knowing where that line is, you have to cross it and then get knocked on your ass. Okay, cool. Today, right now, where I'm in this time and space, my 2-mile run is X. My 1 rep max on this is X. I'm able to read this many pages in this topic, you know, whatever. You can use it in any type of topic. But I just think striving towards that is important. Failure is where all the lessons are. Failure is where the wisdom is. And it is through that process where, as long as you're able to get back up, right, which is critical, and that goes into your work ethic and your heart, really, you're able to extract that knowledge from that failure and ram it back into your system to improve. Improve on a tactical, minutia, small, micro level, or make adjustments to the macro program on how am I going about my everyday life? How do I have this thing phased out? If we're constantly living within our safe little bubble, then we're more than likely not going to make substantial strides. So I just think people's relationship with failure is one that can be improved upon. And I learned those lessons, you know, really hard. You know, it started at Walter Reed up on a prosthetic and, you know, trying to move faster than I could. And I'd wipe out, and my leg would come detached and go whipping across the gym, and I'd smash and knock over a bunch of shit. Okay, like that was rough. Okay, I know that right now I'm not able to do that, but that's okay, right? Get back up, strap the thing back on, you know, and get back to work. And I just think that failure, as long as you get back up, failure is temporary. Defeat is long term. Defeat is forever. When you fall down and you don't get back up, that's defeat.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the physical training, like you've been an athlete all your life, jiu-jitsu. I was a wrestler. Then you have all the time in the gym that are these tiny failures. You're actually looking for it. But then there's a big difference between when you kind of get used to these kind of daily small failures, it becomes more comfortable to be in a failure situation. But then you have these other situations to where it's a very public failure. It's where you maybe you entered a competition, you entered a race, you entered a fishing tournament, you go and you do this, these assessments, like it comes time for, you feel like you're there, but now there's going to be a public assessment. And then that's where it gets even more tricky, because it's like now there's public failure. And there's opinions of others to deal with. And there's, you know, that kind of deal. And it is a different thing. But I do believe that if you are testing yourself and looking for failure every single day on little things like silly workouts, like challenging yourself with somebody that's better than you in wrestling or jiu-jitsu on a regular basis and getting killed, that does seem to make it easier on those big public failures. But those are still hard.
Yeah, you know, huge. And, you know, our pride a lot of times is our biggest adversary. And we see that a lot in the special operations community, right? You tend to have an organization that's full of type A, hyper-competitive individuals, people that are used to being successful, people that are used to being at the top. And then you lump all these people together into the same arena, right? Someone's going to be at the top and someone's going to be at the bottom. And that will change from task to task, day to day, et cetera. But you're able to see how much more traumatic it can be on someone when they're used to winning or they're used to being really good at stuff. And I was no different before my injury, before the military, going through my recovery process, and even today. What I find fascinating is in the jiu-jitsu community, at every gym I've ever trained at, I'll typically help out with the kids class, right? Which usually happens before the adults train. And a lot of them are kids of adults that they're also training and whatnot. Some parents just bring their kids and they sit there and they watch them train. It's unbelievable. And what the feedback I get from the parents is one of the most proud aspects of jiu-jitsu for me personally. And it's because they're in that situation. It's in a public arena, right? They're around other kids and other adults that they don't know, at least not initially. And they're being put on the ground. They're being put in uncomfortable positions. They're gradually getting used to being comfortable in what is inherently uncomfortable situations. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Small minutia, micro adjustments over time, just conditioning, 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 conditioning. And these are kids that are 5, 6, 7 years old. And the feedback from the parents are they have gone up in productivity across the spectrum. They're doing better in school. They're doing their homework. They're listening to me at home more often than they were before. Right. So I think that those micro instances where you are being put in uncomfortable positions, your pride is at stake, you're being embarrassed, but then you come out on the backside and you're fine, right? And life goes on and you learn something and you go back the next day and it doesn't happen as often, or you put someone in an uncomfortable position. That I think can transcend across, and you see it in children and they're like sponges, right? Because they're just soaking things up. But we can apply the same thing as adults. So I think that link between those small failure moments can have an enormous impact across all spectrums of life.
Yeah, for sure. And that's like the microcosm of life is the wrestling gym, the jiu-jitsu gym, the boxing gym, the one-on-one kind of place. It could be the swimming pool, you know, swimmers, tennis players. A lot of the one-on-one individual sports are like that, like just exactly what you're talking about. And you see this big growth. But then like one of the difficult places for people is like, say you're that kid that gets killed for 5 or 6 years, you never win a match. And then all of a sudden, you know, puberty kicks in, testosterone, you know, all of a sudden you're a different kid. And now you're kind of you turn into the big dog. And then there's this, situation to where now you have been getting beat up for so long. Now you're starting to win in this little room that you're in. But how do you then determine, man, I'm just winning in this little room, and I can sit here and I can beat these kids all day long, but I really need to go and be with somebody that's better than me. I really need to put myself back in that position of getting beat every day if I want to get better. And a lot of people, you know, that's where this, you know, you can have this so much of what we're talking about is the growth mindset versus the fixed mindset. And the growth mindset is that you can always improve. The fixed mindset is that this is where you are. And people with fixed mindsets tend to not take as many risks. They tend to get in this position to where they're beating everyone in the room and they don't want to move on to the other room. They don't want to go to the other club where they're not going to be very good. What do you have to say about that, where you have had this growth mindset, but then it kind of you get on a plateau, you get comfortable, and you don't want to take this next step that you probably know you should, but you're just not doing it.
Yeah, Tom, so many great points, man. I'll just touch on two real quick. One is you basically just described me to a degree. As a kid growing up, I got my ass kicked constantly, right? My family and I, we moved about every 12 to 18 months. So I was the new kid all the time, moving around. And that's tough, right? What now would be classified as bullied and as something that is paid attention to back when I was a kid was nothing. That was part of being a kid growing up, and no one really cared, right? A lot of rough times, right? And I look back on those moments now in reflection, and I'm extraordinarily grateful because it conditioned me, right? And that, again, once you know puberty kicked in, I began continuing to work and deciding to build myself up, my confidence, my strength. You know, I got into combat sports and boxing, wrestling, and I think that paid an enormous factor into where I am today. And I am not at the top of any mountain, right? There is someone out there who's better than me at every single thing that I do. But I have come a long way since that small, scrawny kid who was getting picked on and beat up, you know, waiting for the bus every single day. So I think you can look back and be grateful for that stuff and just not necessarily make it so negative, but we're able to sometimes only in reflection look back on moments of full of negativity and extract the positive aspects from it and be grateful for them. Sometimes it just takes years to be able to do that. And the next thing is when it comes to looking for that next ridgeline, which is super important. And, you know, you read any piece of work from just about any successful person out there, and the term satisfied is not in their vocabulary, kind of coming back to vernacular. It doesn't exist, right? Whether you're talking to the CEO, you're talking to a general, right? You're talking to a professional athlete. It doesn't matter the work they do or the life they live. They are constantly looking for that next ridgeline to climb, no matter what. I mean, look at Tom Brady. I'm obviously a huge New England Pats fan, but I'm also a Tom Brady fan. The dude's 42 years old. He's playing out of his mind. It's like, what, dude, right? You're at the top of the mountain. What are you still doing this for? And there's a lot of reasons for that. But he just continues to want to strive. And I think that's a constant across the board when it comes to success.
And that's a great example he could have just said, yeah, I'm done. The Patriots done, but he doesn't. He moves to another team, he doesn't have to. Nobody would have batted an eye, but he's just exactly the situation that we're talking about. Like, why is it that some people see that next ridgeline? It's not enough. And you know, some people might retire, like in that situation, might say, okay, it has been enough for football, but you're going to see that person start a foundation, or you're going to see that person start a business, or you're going to see them do something different that is a different challenge for them. Maybe something hasn't been, maybe they are satisfied. Maybe they are happy with where they are, but they're not satisfied with where they are as a person. And that is going to continue to grow. And I think all of that goes back to mindset. I mean, I think that Tom Brady is probably the epitome of a growth mindset. He can always get better. Doesn't matter how old he gets, he can always play better. And And that is a great example, a perfect example of what we're talking about, that he sees that next ridgeline and he goes for it, even though it could be a horrible public failure, and he's ready to put it on the line.
Yeah, that's it. You know, and I think I know for a fact that kind of mentality exists within every single person to desire continuous growth. I do also think, to talk again about community, that in the ideal community world, from my perspective, is comprised of three aspects: mentors, colleagues, and proteges, right? And that's the goal, is to get to that point. Having a sound mentor or mentors, which nowadays, given how small the world has become with the advancements in technology and social media, you're no longer hamstrung to finding someone who's geographically in the same place as you. You can reach out and you can find people out there that are from all different walks of life, that are pursuing all different kinds of things, and you can rely on them as a mentor and a guide, right? Those colleagues, right? The guys alongside you, your companions, those are the ones that are driven, that are ambitious, that are better than you, that are pushing you. And then you have your proteges, which really is something that you have to earn. And typically they kind of find you, and then there's kind of the circle of life, right? You kind of become the mentor. I think that's the goal. And I think that's an enormous piece of leverage, where if you just don't quite feel that inside you yet, if you have a community like that, they will be there to guide you into that direction, right? Hey, man, you're now at the top of this game in this jiu-jitsu gym, right? You're crushing everybody. Let's get you into a tournament, right? Like, you're not progressing like you were last year because you are the best blue belt or the best purple belt or the best black belt or whatever it is. We need to get you out there. And this is coming from a coach, right? We need to get you out there. You're going to lose. It's going to suck. You're going to be embarrassed. But you know that's how you got to where you are now. Mm-hmm. So let's keep that going, right?
Yes. And that's an easy comparison in athletics and jiu-jitsu and wrestling, and that it can be applied to someone who is doing really well at a job that they could continue to do and continue to crush. But if they have the right boss, the boss says, you know what, we need to make you, we need to put two or three people under you, and you need to manage a team. They're, oh, well, I don't know, man. I don't know if I can do that. I don't have any leadership ability. But the boss is saying, no, you need to grow. You need to stop doing what you're the best at and move on to something else. That's like, I read Jocko's book, and that was one of the things that he talked about, is that what he really wanted to be doing was to be out there with his team, but his position required him to stay back and have decentralized leadership. And that was one of the hardest things for him to figure out, to stop doing the things that he really wanted to do and grow as a person and grow as a leader to move into this other position. And that can be applied to so many different things. When people hear you talk about all of these things and read into your story, and you have a great YouTube presence where you're putting out what I would consider motivational stuff, There is, and what you said, like the mentors, digital mentors, like you can look to people that you can gain motivation for or from all walks of life, from in your business, in athletics, in leadership, in everything. But there's a big difference between motivation and discipline. I wonder if you could touch on that a little bit.
Yeah. Motivation, in my opinion, is, it's nice to have. It's not a requirement. I think it's overrated a little bit, to be honest with you. And, you know, just a quick slice off, I'm reached out to constantly, which I'm super grateful for, and say, hey man, you're an enormous motivation for me, which is a huge win, right? That makes me feel good to know that I have had a small, tiny impact on someone's, even just that hour of their life, right? That's something I'm very proud of. I actually don't seek to motivate people, right? I don't consider myself a motivational speaker or a motivational anything. I live my life by my own set of rules and doing what I want to do, what I feel like I need to do to make me happy and to make me an asset and to contribute to the society and my unit. That I live my life, right? Motivation that I may provide is nothing more than a byproduct of that. And again, it's something I'm very grateful to be able. Motivation itself is a burst, right? It's taking some gasoline and throwing it on a fire, right? And it explodes and it gets hotter and bigger and burns faster and it's great and you fire it up and you're operating at a higher level, right? Whether or not you have the gasoline there, the fire has to continue to burn, right? That's how you survive. That's how you live. The fire is going no matter what. So whether or not you're motivated doesn't mean that if you're not, you don't go do whatever you need to do, right? That's the discipline. I think when you're driven towards a goal, you are able to get the work done anyway. And it may not be at the highest level of production. You may not get the highest ROI on that particular task, but you're still making progress, right? And then that's just generally linked into tightening up your way of life and your time prioritization and just doing the work anyway. Because the only bad workout is the one that didn't happen. And this is not specific to being in the gym. It's we're for all walks of life, right? So I just think motivation is great and we want to look for it. We find it maybe in music or watching a video, or I look at my son and I get motivated just in that one moment. But if we only do the things we need to do when we're motivated, we're not making progress. If I only worked out when I was motivated to do so, I would be severely out of shape. Most of my workouts are done when I'm not motivated, yeah. Right? Most of the times I get out of bed at 04 or whatever it is, I don't feel like doing it, right? So the discipline to do it anyway is what is critical while we're looking for sources of motivation along the way.
Yeah, and that gets to kind of staying on track. And staying on track is, you know, maybe motivation helps you to kind of put your feet on the ground out of the bed, but there's something else that's driving you towards this goal. But that is another really important part of what you continue to talk about is staying on track means that you have plotted a point that you're trying to get to, and not unlike land navigation is how you described it to me as we were kind of talking about this. And I think that's really important too, because you can have false goals, like places that you think you need to be. And if you plot that as your course and you navigate towards that, that may not be the right place. You may be making progress, but you're not going in the right direction. So how does anyone determine what that point is for them, for their goals, for what it means in their life?
Yeah, great question. I kind of have two philosophies or two recommended courses of action, or COAs as we call them in the military for that. One is very simple, and it's just to kind of sit with yourself, right? Find a quiet place, find a park bench, or whatever it is. Put yourself in an environment. It may not happen within 10 minutes. You may have to do it time after time after time, and just be honest with yourself, right? What is it that we want to do? What do I want to do? But more importantly, who do I want to become? And oftentimes dreams don't come screaming into your face, right? Oftentimes they whisper, and you have to really pay attention to what the universe or God or yourself or whatever it is that you want to call it is trying to communicate to you. And then go that route, right? The other route, I think, which if you read some stuff from some really successful people out there, they tend to recommend this, and that is determine your talent or talents. Determine what you do best with the least amount of effort, right? And the difference just quickly between talent and skill is, you know, talent is inherent skill. Talent is a gift. Talent is what you are born with. Skill is only achieved through hours and hours and hours of grinding on a particular craft or thing, right? So two different things. If you're looking to find that goal, a lot of recommendations out there, and I'm not opposed to this, is what is your talent, right? That is almost certainly going to increase your odds of success. And we tend to enjoy the things that we are good at, right? We tend to enjoy the things that we like to listen to. We tend to enjoy the things that we like to watch. We tend to enjoy the things that we can do easier than other people. So if you focus on those talents and then spend the next decade increasing your skill to accommodate your talent, that is a secure way to go. And then I've mentioned this once or twice before, and it's like, well, why wouldn't I just do that? Like, if that's going to increase my odds of success, why wouldn't I do that? And, you know, chances are that's a solid route to take. I'm not detracting from that. I just don't want to leave the option off the table to pursue something that you may be terrible at, but you feel it burning deep down inside. I want to be a school teacher, right? I am awful with kids. I'm awful at math, whatever, but something deep down is telling me I want to be an educator, or I want to build houses, right? I can't stack blocks on each other on the floor of my living room worth a shit, but I want to build homes, right? So no talent at all, but I want to do it because I feel it deep down inside. That's why I put that one up front. I don't like to be limited by anything, right? Even if it's myself, maybe that means I'm a schizophrenic or something, but, if that doesn't work and you're spending time after time after time and you just can't quite find your purpose, maybe we hone in on what our talents are. And it can be something very, very, very small. Right? I cut hair well. I interact with people well. I'm comfortable in social environments. I'm a great reader. Whatever it is, right? Really hone in on what that is and then dedicate the next decade or so, 10,000 hours, according to Malcolm Gladwell in The Outliers. You enhance that skill. And then you know what? I don't think we need to be too hard on ourselves, right? I think that there is at least a decent likelihood that along that journey, the mission may change, right? As life gets thrown at us, we may decide we want to divert. And we just need to be real careful on, are we diverting because I don't want to put in the work? Am I making an excuse? Or am I feeling a deep, burning passion based on the work that I have done to this point that's putting me in that direction? And I was no different, right? I joined the military because I wanted to go work for the Secret Service. That was my goal. Come in, be a Green Beret, get 5 years worth of advanced training, get out of the military, enter the Secret Service, protect the president. That was the goal. The problem was I fell in love with doing what I do, right? And I couldn't imagine doing anything other than that. Does that mean that all the work I had put in to get to where I was at that point as the Green Beret was wasted? No, right? There was a lot of value in that. I just decided that my passion is now for this. So I just re-diverted, adjusted my operational approach, adjusted my plan, and then just kept moving forward.
Mm. Interesting. That's cool. We've talked about so many different things here, and it all kind of keeps circling back to the same thing. It's mindset. It's a growth mindset. There's something that has a theme that has come up many times on this podcast, and a theme that has happened in my life, where you may hone in on your strengths and make a career out of that. But at some point you have to attack your weakness. You have to, like we talked about earlier, you have to have this self-realization that, yeah, you're a house builder, and you've been relying on someone else to do this part of this for you, but you really don't understand it, and you really need to become an expert at this thing that you're terrible at. And it's this theme of weakness is strength. Like, whatever your greatest weakness is, if you attack that weakness, develop it, and turn that into a strength, you're going to develop yourself as a person, or in whatever, as an athlete, as a Green Beret, as whatever it is that you're in, you will develop yourself, and that weakness will soon, at some point, with plenty of discipline and hard work and determination, it will become one of your greatest strengths. That because, you know, maybe it's that you have no money and you want to go to college. Well, you had to get a job, and you have to pay for college yourself. And so you had to work your way all the way through college. Well, later in life, you look back on that and think, you know what I'm the best at? I'm the best at time management. Why is that? I'm the best at time management because I had to work a job and go to school at the same time. So that weakness of not having money to go to school actually turned out to be the greatest strength that I have, because it developed my work ethic. It developed my time prioritization. I became a better person because of that. And it's a really hard thing for a lot of people to see that this weakness, whatever it is, maybe for you, it's that you lost your leg. And now it's like, how does that play into, or does it play into your life at all, that weakness turns out to be a strength?
Yeah, it's interesting, man, because in the self-improvement space, much like the fitness space, it's almost, there are a lot of similarities, but there's also some drastic differences, right? So it can get to a point where it's the more you learn, the less you know, because there's a lot of different philosophies with case studies and whatever to prove whatever they're talking about. So I think it's on us to just expand that wealth of knowledge and then extract what we think we want to use at that time and try it, but not close ourselves off to what else is out there. What's interesting is there is guidance that states that forget your weaknesses, right? Double and triple down on what you're great at and forget everything else. Now, that's a school of thought. And I remember one class I had, Hoist Gracie came to do a seminar at my jiu-jitsu gym, and we were doing different hip tosses. And we were doing, you know, two on the left, two on the right, two on the left, two on the right, et cetera. And he came over and he's like, which side are you stronger at? Well, I'm stronger if I go to my left. And he said, well, then just do that. Well, you know, sir, don't I want to be well-rounded? He's like, no, you have some techniques that you'll hit this way and some that you'll hit this way. And if that doesn't work, rather than trying to do it your weak side, there's another method that you can go that you're strong at, right? I found that mind-blowing, right? I've had other coaches in other sports or aspects of life that have the opposite. No, we need you to be perfectly balanced, right? As good on your left as your right. Shooting, same thing. Go to some shooting schools, advanced shooting schools. They have you do equal drills, left-handed, right-handed, right? Weak hand, strong hand. Try to balance that out. And then other ones are like, no, you're a right-handed shooter. That's how you're going to shoot. Forget everything else. I don't think there's really a right and a wrong. And I think depending on what you're talking about may determine if you need to spend some time. I think macro speaking, perfect balance doesn't exist, right? If you dedicate time and effort towards one thing, you have to relinquish time and effort towards something else. Yeah. And striving for perfect balance and synergy in our lives is an impossible task, right? Even to the most impactful degree. My family is the most important aspect of my life, period. When I'm deployed and I'm conducting operations, I am 110% focused on what I'm doing. I'm not thinking about my wife or my son whatsoever. Does that mean I don't care about them? No, it just means that in this moment, I have to prioritize my time and effort towards this because I have to. And that can be broken down from the super macro to the minute by minute kind of basis, and it's going to kind of teeter totter. My personal opinion when it comes to weaknesses is much like when I was going through rehab and I knew I could do X, Y, and Z, did not mean I neglected the things that I couldn't do at that moment or the things I was terrible at, physically and otherwise, right? I couldn't do this exercise, but I can read about cultural dynamics in Iraq, right? I don't enjoy that, and I'm very weak at that right now. But I am going to dedicate time towards the things that I'm not good at. And it turned out, because of the emphasis I placed on those factors of my life where I was weak, once I got back and I was back on the team, all of those avenues that I had explored brought tremendous value to what we were trying to do. It increased my stock personally, which is great, but it increased what we were doing collectively by an enormous degree, right? So I do think that there is an enormous advantage to spending time and effort and dedication towards the things that we are weak at, things that we don't enjoy, and getting past that fear. I think that fear is what stops us from doing that more often than not, fear of embarrassment, fear of failure, fear of whatever. And I am convinced that the greatest moments in life exist on the far side of fear. We just have to get past that to be able to recognize it. And then it makes it easier the next time, the time after that.
Nice. Have you ever thought about putting some of this down in an organized fashion, like a course or something?
Yeah, man. It's funny you mention it.
We have some people that I'm working with have actually started on a book project, which is, if you asked me 3 years ago, if I would ever, I was asked, hey, you're going to write a book? My answer was no, absolutely not. Get away from me. I got things I got to do. And there's a lot of reasons behind that, you know, especially in the soft community. There's a lot of literature out there and kind of war story type memoirs, which are great. It's just kind of, it can be viewed as kind of lame. Mm. It can be viewed as a very busy space. And I knew I didn't want to do that. But listening to the advice and the guidance of some mentors and some people that I respect, I have decided to move forward on something. It's not an autobiography. It's not a biography. It's not a bunch of cool guy stories in Afghanistan. It is it's a piece that exists within the space that you and I are talking about right now. It's about self-improvement. It's about getting over adversity. And it's about really success in general, but through the lens of having some really difficult challenges in front of you. So it reads kind of like a manual, like a typical kind of self-improvement book, but I do have some personal experiences and some vignettes kind of interwoven into it. So it's something that it's a little bit further along than I thought it would be at this point. So I'm thinking, you know, when we get back from this next deployment here, I'm taking off here pretty soon. It'll be out there, man. So, nice. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to read that. Cause I certainly have enjoyed the conversation that we've had today. There is in your profession, there is the term, the quiet professional. And, it was that any kind of a line to kind of, to be careful of as you go down into writing a book or putting something out there? I mean, you're saying I guess you said that it's not cool guy stories and all of that. So where is that line as you have all this tremendous knowledge about success that could be applied to so many different areas in so many different people's lives that have been tested and forged in fire? Where is the line between the quiet professional and sharing your knowledge?
Yeah, man, great question. And it's something that is still difficult for me, knowing what I'm doing and I know my reasoning behind it. It's still tough. That's an extraordinarily fine line to try to walk. I'll go back to General Cleveland again. Fast forward to me getting out of the hospital. I'm back at Fort Bragg. He was coming through Fort Bragg. He had some visitors from the Beltway that were coming down to talk about some stuff. And a lot of it was focused on our strength conditioning program. And he asked me to come over and talk to them about my experience with them, my experience back in Afghanistan. This was immediately following my first deployment back to Afghanistan as an amputee. And I'm like, sir, I really have no interest in doing anything like that, right? I live the quiet professional, which is something that was ingrained in me as a child, mostly from my father. You know, don't talk about it, be about it, walk softly, but carry a big stick. That was kind of just his whole thing, just blue collar working class, just get out there, let your actions speak for itself. I come into SF and that's one of our mottos. So I lived it. And I wasn't unable to recognize the difference between a quiet professional and a silent professional. And General Cleveland, with one sentence, opened up my eyes. He said, hey, man, I understand what you're saying. I respect that. But this isn't about you. Right. This is about the guys coming up behind you, the people coming up behind you. You have an obligation to them to share your experiences, your lessons learned, because you did something that no one's done and you owe it to them to make their challenge a little less challenging. And when he framed it like that, it was like a light bulb went off. Right. And I still have a difficult time being in the limelight. I still would prefer to remain in the shadows and just kind of grind. But I do accept that as an obligation that I have. And just as long as I kind of keep that frame in mind, man, it's not about me. It's about those that may benefit from it, allows me to at least attempt to walk that line.
Nice. I like it. Well, I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to read it. If, and I know you've got a hard stop here in just a little bit. So we're going to probably, start to bring this to a close, but I just want to thank you for spending the kind of time and being as open and willing to talk about all of this different stuff as you have. It's been a great conversation. Do you have anything you want to add to the conversation at all? Close it out.
Yeah, Tom, I'll just say, man, I appreciate it. You know, Scott is a good friend. He speaks very highly of you.
He's a good dude.
Great dude, right? He's gonna do a lot of things out there, man. Another ambitious. He's the type of guy that I keep close, right? He's in that community because he's also striving. I'll just say this isn't about personally. It's just when we look at greatness, right? People who are great, people who have done great things, we tend to want to summarize them as someone who is from another planet, someone who's cut from a different cloth, someone who has been genetically gifted and that they are predisposed, preconditioned for greatness. And that is not the case whatsoever, right? I was in that same boat. I'm still in that same boat. What I've come to realize is that greatness exists within every single one of us, right? Every single one of us, human flesh, blood and tissue. And it's just a matter of getting your mind wrapped around who you want to become and then putting in that work to get it done. And that's it. You know, so I just, people want to reach out, which tends to happen. I do have a website that's somewhat recent. It's machinenick.com. It's got the links to my socials and there's an email to hit me up directly. By all means, reach out. Sometimes it takes a while to get back, but I make it a point to get back. So by all means, you know, I'm here for you guys. So I appreciate it, Tom. It's been great talking here.
Absolutely. And you got a great Instagram. I follow you on Instagram, machine.nc. And you should definitely look at that, the YouTube as well. How do they find you on YouTube?
Nick Charles.
Nick Charles on YouTube. And yeah. Great stuff, man. So thanks so much. I wish you all the very best of luck in every endeavor as a parent, as a Green Beret, as a new author, as so many of the things that you got going on. Wish you all the very best of luck. I want to have you on the show again. We'll make that happen. But thanks so much for today. I really appreciate it. And everybody go check out all his stuff. It's definitely worth your time. All right, that's it for today. We'll be back with another awesome guest next week. And that's it. See ya.
You'd think, with four of us spread out on a tiny island, that the task of tagging a whitetail would not be a big thing. But, as I've learned, no matter where I've been, whitetails can be damn tricky.
Pursuing wild game in wild places. Tune in to Hunt Stand Presents Saturdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
You want to succeed. You want to fish. You want to be one of the greatest.
Tune in to West Marine's Life on the Water, presented by Costa Custom Boats, every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.